You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Dan, who are we talking to today?
We are talking with the boss, Pat Goodwin.
It's probably the most important person in your career. Am I right?
Yeah, sure. I wouldn't challenge that.
Yeah, I would say arguably that.
Pat Goodwin, casting director extraordinaire, is here with us today, and we're excited to have him.
I don't know if you've heard of any of the shows like Frozen, Mean Girls, Come From Away, Wicked, Hamilton, Wicked, Pretty Women, Network, Be More Chill, Wicked, Beetlejuice, Wicked, Torch Song, Oklahoma, Wicked, various shows like that.
Finding Neverland, Kinky Boots, Wicked. American in Paris, If Then, Newsies, Wicked, Bridges of Madison County, Wicked.
In the Heights, South Pacific.
What else?
But we're going to talk about all that stuff, and we love him, and we're glad he's here, and we're going to sell you something.
So an actor is saying his lines, and then out of nowhere, he just starts singing.
5, 6, 7, 8.
The hills are alive with the sound of Jimmy. Don't cry for me.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I made that joke yesterday. I don't know if I can make it twice, Dan, about the ads.
Well, you certainly try.
Now you'll get Pat Goodwin. Thank you for being on our show.
Hey, Pat.
Hello. Thank you, guys. You are crazy for that intro, but I appreciate it.
Does it feel overwhelming to be you when you look at this list? I'm looking at this list like,
well,
wow.
That's all Telsey and Company stuff. Not all of those are mine, but it's definitely overwhelming when you hear it in any capacity. I mean, our office has been fortunate enough to work on so many things, but it's also makes me feel a little bit old because some of those things that I did work on were so long ago. But hey, I'll take it. I've been in the industry long enough to be a semi-pro at what I do. I guess that's how I'll read it.
Total pro. Well, I made the joke about you and Dan's career because we'll get right to it, that you gave our man his Broadway debut, put Dan in Waitress. And
that is true.
You know, so we want to talk about that. And I always love to put people on the spot and be like, okay, so what do you remember specifically about Dan's audition and how good was it?
Well, I will say, I did not cast Dan in Waitress. That was a very clear, good example of Dan earning that part. Like that, there's times when, you know, you definitely champion people and you root for people along the way. You root for everybody that walks through a door, or through any casting room door.
Right.
But I think in Dan's situation, he came in so well prepared in a track that was so difficult and was given so much material. And again, I would like to say that I had more to, I wish I could brag and say, yeah, that was my doing. Dan really earned that. He really did. And I think it's specifically for that show, and Dan can tell you this, it is so hard with the tracking and with the understudying and with all that stuff that you have to be on your game when you come in because they give you so much stuff. And, you know, I can go on forever about why I don't agree with giving people that much material, but it was very much him that earned that job.
It's the full Dr. Pometer. Joe, I think you may or may not have gone in for this track, but it's the full Dr. Pometer packet, which is Bad Idea and You Matter to Me and three scenes.
Yep.
So that's about 14 pages, plus the Earl packet, which is both of Earl's scenes. And I guess you didn't have me sing the song, but that may have been in the packet. And it was just like, okay, here you go.
Right. Yeah, it's insane. And like, look.
But what you did do for me, before you continue, is that you laughed the minute I opened my mouth. I will probably never forget when I laid down the doula's punchline. You you totally bought it. And I was like, okay, I'm good. Joe knows that, like, once you get that little bit of feedback that you need in a comedy audition, you feel much more comfortable.
Totally.
You know,
I wouldn't be laughing for the sake of laughing. You probably genuinely made me laugh in that moment.
That's true.
Well, that's a great point, Dan. And I wonder, Pat, from your perspective, that you've seen these sides, you know, when you're working on a show, I mean, you've seen a million people audition. You've seen a lot of people come in and do the same scenes and the same when it's a comedy like that over and over and over again. Do you tend to lean into, like, hey, here's a laugh line. Like, I've heard it 1,000 times, but, like, I know the actor needs a laugh here, and I know the director's not going to laugh. I know that Barry Weissler's not going to laugh. So am I going to laugh for, you know, to, like, help and, like, create a warm room like that? Do you actively do that, or?
You know, you have to make me laugh. It has to be funny. There has to be some substance there in terms of the comedic, you know, back and forth of what's going on in the scene. But if it's a really well-written line and you have 10 actors coming in that given day to show you what they got for that role, chances are they're going to do 10 different takes on that kind of comedy, and it's going to make me laugh.
Nice.
I think sort of performative cheerleading in that sense doesn't really help anybody. And if you're doing the work, and if you're really putting in the time and effort to figure out how to land those laughs in a way that's honest and genuine, then you're already doing that for us. You're giving us that sort of way to laugh without having to fake it. And Dan definitely did that in his audition. And, you know, it makes me go back to thinking about when Drew Galen came in for the role.
Right.
And we saw so many guys for Pomander, and so many of them were incredibly funny and incredibly well-prepared. But then when someone like Drew comes in and does his own unique, weird, quirky spin on it, it's like a gift to everybody in that room to go, oh, that's how it's supposed to go. And now let's build off of that. And I think the person that ends up getting the job is usually the person that is the most creative in figuring out how to make that comedy work in their own way without having to, you know, pigeonhole themselves into something.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Because that was the thing about Dr. Pomander, is that a lot of the laughs that Drew got, I mean, just this is just from being in the show. It's not necessarily even like how you would audition the material, but like being in the show for a long time, you watch some of the stuff he does. It's not a joke, but the audience laughs.
Right. Exactly.
So like that's this whole thing, which is you can't really pull off in auditions because they've heard it thousands of times, but you still have to have the courage to come in and give it that take.
Yeah.
And Drew's was very interesting because it wasn't over the top. It was very like, obviously crazy, but it didn't feel unrealistic.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Right.
And look, at the end of the day, I'd rather see any bold choice than no choice. Like, make the choice and let it fall flat on its face. I'd rather see that than nothing.
Right. Right. But you'd rather have absolutely the wrong choice and absolutely the right choice as opposed to like milk toast, boring, you know, boring
exactly.
in the middle.
Exactly. And you know what I tell a lot of people have asked me in, you know, the past few years, what are the best auditions that you can think of? What stand out in your mind? And I would say 7 out of the 10 best auditions I've ever seen across the board, ironically, are people that don't ultimately end up booking the job. And it's the people that make you sort of remember them in a different way, even if they don't book, even if that wasn't the exact fit that creative team was looking for in that specific project. Those are the people I want to see in auditions more in for TV and film, for different theater projects, for all sorts of things, because they're able to come in and give such a unique read of what's going on. And I don't think that just applies to comedy, but, you know, I think about, you know, years ago, I was the associate on this pilot for CBS, and Julianne Nicholson came in, who is an unbelievable actress and in my mind can do no wrong. She's just brilliant. And she was auditioning for a small part alongside Patrick Wilson in this pilot and made the ridiculous choice on this one line just to scream it in a moment of like catharsis. It wasn't in the script. It wasn't, you know, even, you know, alluded to that that's what the character needed to do in that moment, but it fits so well in terms of what she was doing in that moment. That I just sat there going, she's a genius, you know, and she didn't book that pilot. And then you look years later and she's in the August Osage County film and she's in so many other films and so many TV appearances. And it's like those 7 out of 10 actors that don't book the job, they're the ones I want to see more and more and more in auditions, because you know, they're going to do great work and you know, they're going to take those chances to to try to make something land. And if it doesn't work, that's okay.
Oh my gosh. Do you remember any others? Like any other, like of those 7 to 10 ones you could share? Because that story, I could literally sit here and listen to those stories all day long.
You know, I will say, I will preface this by saying that I do think everybody that ends up booking a job books it for a reason, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was another time when in replacement casting, Jessica Voss came in for Waitress. And I just, and yep. Look,
I always was hoping that she would come in.
And she's, look, you listen to her on her album or on, you know, bootlegs right. or whatever. She's ridiculous. She's just ridiculous in terms of how she sings. And I remember her coming in for this audition, and it was, I think this was pre-Wicked. She hadn't gone into Wicked as Elphaba yet. And I remember listening to her on the material going, and it was just such an awakening for me because I knew her as a little bit in terms of the audition world, but more as a friend and more as listening to her, her album and her other things that she had done. And it was just so mind-blowing to me how great she was with the scenes. I never, you know, thought of her as sort of that nuanced, specific, comedic, smart, different actress. I knew she was a great actress, but I didn't know she had the layers that she was showing us in that day. And again, it was one of those times where she did every single thing she should have done in that room. Within her power. We all know that there's many things actors right. don't have within their power. She did everything as if there were a checklist and was just going right down and knocking them all off. And at the end of the day, it wasn't quite the fit for what they needed at that time. And it wasn't quite the person that they saw in the role. And that was okay. But again, selfishly, I am so glad I saw that side of her. Because now she will pop into my head if there's roles similar to that that I feel like she should have the opportunity to come in for if she wants to. And, you know, yeah, there's so many examples like that where I wish everybody understood that just because you don't book the job from a casting perspective, at least, just because you don't book the job doesn't mean you didn't nail the audition, period. Like, I try to teach my students at Pace that when I talk to them, I try to, you know, encourage young people whenever I'm invited to talk to teenagers or preteens about stuff. The thing I hope people understand through those kinds of stories is that your work is your work in the audition room and outside the audition room. And whether or not it translates to a paid job is a little bit of luck and a little bit of being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And so I'm a firm believer of that. And I could joke, go on and give you many other stories like that, but we don't have to do that today.
No, I
that's
appreciate
so
that.
Good. Yeah. There's something there I want to highlight that is, you know, something unlocked for me. It took a couple years after graduation where you realize that you're not auditioning for the job. You're developing your collaboration with each of the casting directors in a way.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't know that Jessica Voss has that in her, if you don't know what Joe has in him, then you're not going to think of him when you go and put these things together. So you kind of have to just be bold, always do good work, always be prepared for yourself and for your relationship with casting and how those projects could turn out in the future.
Absolutely. Right? And that's how we... You know, I don't want to say we have favorites and that we bring in the same people every time, but that's how we have people that we want to champion for things. Right. That's totally. Always how it works. And there's a whole list of people like that that I want to see for every single project, just because every time they come in the room, they surprise me and do great work and are building on that relationship in a way that I hope puts them in a position to book more things down the line.
Totally. Well, I remember when we graduated that, you know, and even up until very recently, I feel like one of the things that all of us tried to do was like, we want the respect of the people at Telsey. Your organization and that, you know what I mean, is such a wonderful, you guys do so much good work. You're the top of the mountain as far as casting is concerned. And we want to be on that list. Like all of us want to like, get to that point where we're like, you know, hey, Pat's thinking of me for this thing. You know, Adam's thinking of me for this thing. Rachel's thinking of me for this thing. And I feel like really in the last couple of years that has started to happen where, you know, I feel like some of that work has started to pay off where I'm like, you know, I've gone in for you enough times. I've gone in for Rachel enough times to, you know, to say like, you know, I hope that that is, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm rambling now, but like,
is there a question?
There's no question there. There's no question there.
I understand what you're saying though. I totally get what you're like. I respect anybody that puts in the time and work, whether I see you once or whether I see you 50 times, right? Like, right, I think there's a respect that goes in. You have to love actors if you're a casting director, and you have to respect them and the time and money and sacrifices that they put into just putting together an audition. Like, as simple as that, like what we don't even see in the room, we respect, mm-hmm. right? But I do think, I'm very grateful to work where I work. And I think that working in an office like Telsey, where you do have so many people around you that are bouncing ideas off each other and giving you feedback about other people that came in for projects, so you get to know them a little bit better. I think there's also with that a little bit of a misconception that there's like a Telsey favorite list and then the non-favorite list. And that is like the furthest thing from the truth. Cause where I think about it, if I'm working on a new job, of course there's people that are going to come right to mind when I get a breakdown together and submissions come in. But I'm just as excited to go to EPAs and ECCs and pre-screens and see people that I've never seen before, because that's only going to, you know, diversify that pool of talent in X, Y, Z amount of ways that's going to help you in the long run. And so I think people, because our office is large in number in terms of the people that work there and in terms of the number of projects that we are fortunate enough to have, think that there's a little bit of a club there. But it's not. It's really not. It's about, you know, it's about the relationships you're building with that casting director, but it's just as important to creatively get your foot in the door in a way that you can, whether that's going to an open call, whether it's sending in a self-tape, whether it's going to an ECC, or whether it's, you know, finding a way through your agent or manager to get in the door at a pre-screen. I think that that's an important thing just to distinguish, is that there's never going to be someone hired because they happen to know that person really well. They still have to do the work and prove themselves. And that's where those relationships pay off a lot of time, because you get to learn about specifically what you think that casting director is going to expect from you.
Oh, I love. Can I
circle back to something? I have a lot of very specific questions.
So, shoot, go for it.
Which is better than my rambling about how I'm just grateful to have gone in for Waitress 5 times, and you know that every time that I see Pat Goodwin's name on my email, I'm like, oh, he wants to see me again. I didn't screw up last time. That's
Joe is just in hot pursuit of trying to be loved. You know, aren't we all?
I love you, Joe. You don't have to try that hard. Come on.
All right.
That is another thing that I want to get to, but first. In like the desperation and the wanting to impress and all of that stuff, I feel like that's probably a trap you can speak to. But specifically, going back to what you were saying about making bold choices, I've always been a fan of bold choices that actually have to do with the scene. Is there too wild a choice? Is a choice ever too weird that it doesn't even make sense? And then you're like, oh, now you're just trying. Now you're just desperate. Now you're just trying to stand out.
Absolutely. Because then it becomes so not rooted in honesty within the scene that it becomes wildly transparent that you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And, you know, I think all the time when I specifically think about people saying make strong choices, one of the people I love working for is Tina Landau, because she's such a proponent of real collaboration and communication with actors and respect for actors and spending time with them in the room and working with them. And she's all about, whether it's, you know, SpongeBob or whether it's, you know, a play that she's doing at the Public that's a drama, she's really into show me the choices that you think are within the realm of this character in this world. And I think you can push the limits in some directions, but if you're doing something just for the sake of making a tear fall down someone's cheek or making somebody laugh, it's got to be more than that. It's got to be rooted in something deeper in the text or deeper in, you know, in your interpretation of who that person really is, because otherwise you're not serving anybody. You're just serving yourself.
Mm. Ooh, that's good. That's good. Put that on the t-shirt.
it's hard because I think that right there is like a contradiction. You know, it's like you want to make really bold choices, but you also have to be rooted in the story. So then you spend a lot of this time kind of trying to guess what's right. And that's like the downfall.
Totally. And I think another part of that though, where we start to interpolate things based on the choices, are who's done their homework and who hasn't. Because if you're given a script, if you're given an entire score, if you're given scenes that you don't actually end up doing in the room, but it's a little bit more of a contextual basis of information that you can feed off of, then that helps inform those choices better than just a shot in the dark. And then, right. you know, to that, I know so many actors say, well, what if it's a brand new work, if it's a reading or a workshop or a very undercover pilot that you're not allowed to give any information out on? Then I hear you. It's so hard because then you have to go with your gut instinct and you have to go with what you think is going to, at the end of the day, serve the purpose for you being in that room. But also homework is a huge part of it. Dig, dig, dig. Like I had a student at Pace say to me once, like, how exactly do you do the homework once you're given an appointment beyond singing the right notes and saying the words? And it was like mind blowing for them to hear that I was suggesting, like, get lost down a rabbit hole of YouTube in terms of every other person that's played that role and get your hands on a copy of a script, even if it means that script isn't necessarily public, but you know somebody that might have access to it, you know, all right. of those things are fair game. And I think use it, use whatever you can to your advantage and do the homework of the people that are behind the table, not just the casting director, but the music director, the choreographer, all those folks, so that you get to know what their taste is and what you think they're going to respond to. That part of it is a little bit of a guessing game based on homework.
Totally. Totally.
Well, this is 20 minutes of value. I'm loving this. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, minus my like rambling in the middle, but yes. But, yeah.
Forgive yourself, dude. It's okay.
No, that is, we forgive that's you. So good. And this is the thing that I find with some students too, not to be like super old man boomer about it. That's one of Dan's nicknames for me because I don't know how to use the internet. That like the homework, I love the homework. I always loved the homework. I loved that aspect of it. Are you seeing anything different now? Is people come up that like they're in general not as interested to do a deep dive into, you know, oh my gosh, what was Tina Landau doing before this, before that, you know, like putting, you know what I mean? That sort of homework?
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you're talking about. I think more often than not, I am shocked by how much people know when they walked in a room just because they have so much more at their fingertips with social right. media and with the internet and with a yeah. lot of people in the industry they can talk to about those directors who are maybe an age demographic removed from who they are. I'm always impressed when a 22-year-old who just showcased, who is coming in for a project for the first time, has such a clear knowledge of everything that's expected of them in the room and everything that that creative team wants. Like, it's clear to me in those situations that they have done something that other people are not doing in that audition process. And they have
right.
really put in the time and effort to say, okay, I got these notes down. I got the scene worked down. I'm comfortable with it. I'm going to try to get it off book. But now I want to go and see what kind of stuff Mary Mitchell really writes for this kind of voice. And I want to see what kind of stuff, you know, Diane Paulus is going to want to see in a room. And I want to know what Jack O'Brien responds to. All of that is fascinating to me because even 10, 15 years ago, that wasn't happening just because of the lack of information flow. But now everything's sure. all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah, you make a really good point there. Like, I was able, let me talk about me for a
Please
second.
Please do.
I was able to memorize the accent of Charlie Price in Kinky Boots because of the internet. I knew all of the choreography to, I mean, I didn't book the show, but I knew all of the choreography to basically everything I've ever had to do a dance call of, because I know I don't do well in dance calls. The one that got me was Waitress, but thankfully that was like a, you know, that was a movement call. It wasn't wasn't meant to trip us up, you know. You're totally right, though. You have to kind of use what's out there. When I did that October Sky workshop, I literally took the staging from the press release video and I brought it into my audition. And the director said, I'm so floored. You did exactly what my vision is for the show. And I was like, I know, right?
You're like,
we're totally simpatico.
We're totally simpatico. Have you heard of YouTube?
Just like, but you know,
that's awesome.
It's clear when you're going to go in to play, you're going to go in to play a role that Drew Gehling has played. You can get a sense of what Drew Gehling is right. like. And we have that stuff at our fingertips. So you got to do that work. I love that. I love that advice. How do you tell, Pat, if somebody is right for something?
Oh, it's so dependent on the project, because the definition of right is always going to vary depending on what the mold is you're trying to fill. My favorite version of a project is when a director comes in and says, there's no such thing as right. There's just people who are going to come in and do really great work. And I think those are two different things. And sometimes people mix those and go, oh, it's absolutely the same. And I love when directors, you know, in any sense of the word, separate them. A lot of times it's a gut reaction of that director feeling like it's really in line with what the writing is and in line with what the music is and what the dance necessity is for whatever that role is. And other times, and this is where I think, this is why I love being a casting director, the times when you have a director, like perfect example, Liesl Tommy, another one who I would drop anything to do in any moment. Like if she told me tomorrow she had a job, I'd be like, I'll pay you to do it. Great. but she was somebody, I remember when we were doing that incredible Les Mis she put together in Dallas, she was like, I want you to throw out every version of Les Mis that's ever been in your head when you're deciding who to bring in for these parts. Mm. And having somebody say that to you is like Christmas morning. It's like, oh my gosh, this is great. I know I'm limited by what's on the page in terms of the music and with the words, but everything else goes away. And when you have those opportunities to bring in who you think is quote unquote right, you get to paint a different picture for that entire production, not just for what that director is looking for in that moment. And it's so rare that that happens, that when you do get those opportunities, it makes you even more so want to make that director proud and make them really understand why you brought in the people that you brought in.
Yeah.
So I guess to sort of make I'm rambling, but I think the best way to sort of put that into one compact pie, if you will, is you're never going to know until you know what the project is, who's behind the table on that creative team, and if there's any ifs, ands, or buts that come with that. It's so different for every project I've ever worked on, who is right in terms of what the writing is, in terms of what the taste of that team is, and in terms of the artistic necessities that you have to have on that stage.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
It's fun to have you here for so many reasons, but one of the things I was excited about was the conversation that we can have that's not right outside the room. Whenever we see each other, it's always right outside a room. And it's like, how are you? I'm good. How are you? Good. Okay, so here's the person that's in the room. Great to see you. Thanks for coming in. How did you get started in casting? How'd this journey start for you?
Oh, it's so weird and convoluted. It's just weird, but I'll give you the short version of it. Well, to back up one step from the short version, I knew I either wanted to be an actor or a lawyer. And because of that, I knew I couldn't commit myself to a conservatory program. I wanted something that would let me do both. And I found a small liberal arts school in New Jersey called Drew University that let me double major in theater and political science. And so I did that. And you would think by the time I was 22 and in the second semester of my senior year, I would have made up my mind what direction I wanted to go in. I did not. I had both taken the LSATs and applied for grad acting programs. I'd gotten into both. And a professor of mine very smartly said, I remember, I will never forget this for as long as I live. He called me out of another class that I was in and asked me to come to his office. I was like, oh God, I did something wrong. I'm getting fired from Urine Town. I don't know what's happening. So I sat in his office and he said, you cannot go to law school. You cannot go to grad school. And I was like, oh, immediately thinking again, I'm in trouble. I did something wrong. I was like, oh, okay, can I get a little bit more than that? He's like, you don't know who you are yet. You have no idea who you are as a human being, and you have no idea who you are as an artist. You have to go live your life for a little while and then decide what you want to do. And I remember immediately wow. being like, so my immediate response in my own brain was, how dare he? Like, I put in so much work to get into these programs. You know, I got into, I think it was 3 law schools and 4 grad programs. And I had like any pick of them that I wanted to do. And here he is telling me, nope, you should ditch all of them and go be a waiter in the city for a while, which is exactly what I ended up doing after a lot of thought. And wow. I went to the city. I was bartending at night while I was living in Hoboken. And I didn't go to a conservatory program that showcased, so I never had an agent. So I went to a lot of open calls and ECCs as a non-union actor trying to get seen. And during that time, I was having, you know, little successes here and there coming in for things, but I realized I had most of my days full or empty, actually, in terms of not having stuff to do. So I said, why don't I try doing an internship and be really type A, and I can make it all work out with my night job and my auditioning and all that. Lo and behold, the internship I ended up at was Telsey & Company. So I started interning during the day at Telsey, taking little breaks during lunch and all that to do auditions. And then at 6 o'clock, I would get the bus back to Hoboken and I would bartend till 2 a.m. And that was my life for like a year. And then eventually Bernie had said, his old assistant had left and said, I know that this isn't really what your career path is at the moment, but if you'd like to be my assistant temporarily, we can do that and still have you go on your auditions if you want. And that way you wouldn't have to take, you know, take the bus home at 6 o'clock to go bartend for all these hours unless you wanted to. Mm-hmm. So I interned, became his assistant, and I immediately fell in love with it. I realized very quickly how many actors were so much better than I was, but more importantly, were so much more committed than I was. I learned so much about myself between 22 and 24 in terms of, look, I'm somebody that now knows I need a steady paycheck and I want to make sure I have health insurance. And I want to make sure that, you know, I am artistically and business involved in some way, that I'm using both sides of my brain. And now 15 years later, I'm still here.
Wow. That is so cool.
Yeah.
But it's the marriage, like you said, it's the marriage of both sides of your brain. Exactly. You have to schedule and be like a businessman like crazy, but then it's extremely artsy fartsy. It's like, I love, that's such a cool story.
It's totally
what I wanted to do. To the parents out there, if your kid doesn't know about, you know, like listen, that is, it's possible. God, that's so great.
Well, I wish I knew that casting was a job, a career growing up. I never knew what it was until I fell into it. And that's part of the reason now why I try so hard in the educational world to make sure people know it's something that you can do. And I'm trying to create a minor at Pace University. I created a casting course that I teach there. And I'm hoping that, especially now with the social justice movement we have going on, I'm hoping more pipelines are created that people understand that it is something that you can do and it is artistic and you are still an artist if you're a casting director, because I did not know that that was even an option when I was 21, 22 years old.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's so cool. And I do, I think we hear that a lot from casting directors. I think a lot of casting directors, you know, don't realize it was a career path.
Yeah.
You know, you start, that's why I love asking casting directors where they get started, because I think very few, like, you know, at 18 are like, I want to be a casting director. Well, I guess that's changing. Hopefully that's changing.
You yeah. know? Yeah. And right. it's, I even have someone I'm mentoring at the moment that was a former student who wants to be a casting director, and she's so smart in terms of how she's researching different ways to get her foot in the door and different people she can meet and events she can go to put a name to a face. And yeah, it's fascinating to me that that is sort of the rebirthing of this as a career, not just as sort of a freelance job that you can do here and there, or somebody that is hired at the sidelines of a show to do something very small. It's something very integral to the creation of theater.
100%.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great.
We would love to do we would love to talk about your favorite project to cast or your favorite show to cast and do a deep dive on one of your projects.
Oof.
What do you think about that?
I am cool with that. I mean,
is that like picking a child?
It is. It really is for me. And I know I'm going to have the worst Catholic guilt about it.
Right.
Look, at the end of the day, there's always two that I come back to. I've only been doing this 15 years, so I know that I'm saying this within the scope of that being a fairly limited amount of time in terms of the amount of stuff I've done. I'm definitely not as well-versed as many other people in my community that have done this for much longer. But the two shows that I always come back to that I always am so grateful for are Waitress and Annie. And I think for very different reasons, obviously, because they're very different shows. But the two of them really taught me so many staples of how to be a good human being in tandem with being a good employee and a good artist. And I was so fortunate in both of those projects to have people on the creative team that taught me so much about how to make art in their different ways and how to encourage people and how what we do as artists is always more than being on a stage with a light in your face. And I think about Ariel Tepper all the time, who was the producer on Annie, and she's now the chair of the board at the Public Theater and is just an incredible human being. But at the very beginning of the Annie search, which was a two-year-long search for those girls all over the country, it was incredible and hilarious and hard work and all of that. But she always said at the get-go of it, I want this process to be more just as much about self-esteem and self-empowerment for these girls as it is about show business and performing arts. And I was like sold on that from the get-go because, you know, you hear so many people say they want to do that, but she really put it into practice in terms of, you know, the people that she would get to come and, you know, be co-sponsors for certain events. There were magazines she reached out to make sure that they did, you know, sort of co-sponsored things within their publication for the purposes of these girls feeling good about themselves and not just going to an audition feeling like they didn't book a job if they didn't book a job. And I'm so grateful for that because it's always stuck with me that whether you're an actor, a casting director, anything you do artistic in our community, there has to be another reason for doing it other than just making commercial theater.
Totally.
There's gotta be a message. There's gotta be something else. And I loved it. Again, James Lapine is one of the kookiest guys you'll ever meet, but I will work for him any day.
He's a legend.
And then you have the other side where you think about, he sure is. And I was so intimidated. Oh my God, the first day I was in the room with him for a project, I was so intimidated, but he's not. He likes to play intimidating and he's really not at all. And then the other side of the coin, you have Waitress, which was for me, the first time that I ever did a real deep dive into a pop musical from the very beginning. And I had done a lot of stuff that was contemporary musical theater and even pop stuff, but came in later on in the process and wasn't there during the development. And to watch Jesse Nelson and Sarah Bareilles put that together the way they did, to me was a masterclass in so many different things. But man, I got to give Sarah Bareilles herself so much credit for all the good that's come out of that show because she really was so vocal in the developmental process about what she demanded. And I don't say that in a negative light in any sense. She demanded a certain kind of professionalism and voice and diversity and different body shapes and, you know, not encouraged us not to think within confines of gender roles or race or anything. And I gotta say, when you have somebody at the top demanding it, man, it makes your job so much more enjoyable in every sense of the word. And I know people say that all the time about Lin-Manuel Miranda with Hamilton. And it's so true because when you have that voice that's saying, this is my project, I am creating this and here's what I demand, you respect them for it and you want to board that train and you want to go on that journey with them. And thankfully it was a team that listened to her and really embraced both her and Jesse in terms of creating that. And I'm forever going to be grateful for that experience. It just, it makes me miss it so much. And it makes me, I'm going to bother her until the day she dies about making another show. I'm absolutely going to.
I did the same thing. Drunk on closing night, I was like, you need to write another musical. I can't even tell you. It's so important. This is such a good experience for all of us. Like, you owe the world this.
I had a similar moment. Like,
okay, Dan, you're great.
No, listen, you are not the only person that's done that. I had a very similar moment with her at the tour opening in Cleveland where we all had way too much to drink. And I was just like, Sarah, just write another show. Just do it. It'll be great. And she was like, I am so tired. It is so hard. It is so hard to do this. And I was like, yeah, it is hard, but look at what you made. You made a pie and it works and people love it. And I really will do anything for her. I mean, she's a gem of a human being to work for. And more importantly, I am so grateful for her giving me that gift of her really trusting me, a male, working on a female-centric show, which was a big question I had at the beginning, whether I should even take it or not, or whether it was the right thing I should be doing. But right. I'm grateful she trusted me with it and everything that came with it, because I hope, in the whole, it's made me a much better casting director.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I can't thank you enough for allowing me to be in that room and all of that. There were two things that I learned from her that I think are worth mentioning here, since you brought her up, is that I used to tell people she was not just one of the most welcoming, grounded, kindest celebrities, but people, like one of the better human beings I've ever met, which was a lesson. And then additionally, it was such a good example of going above and beyond because you care, and how much that means, especially when you're at a highest level, but really when you're at any level. Like, that is the best example for a company, is that Sarah Bareilles is in the audience watching my first rehearsal as Earl, and then spends 30 minutes with me telling me what she thinks about who Earl is, because she's now done the show for 2.5 years. And you're like, you don't need to be here. You're making another Grammy album. What? You're like, why are you here? This isn't even your job, but you care. And now I'm going to care about this show because you led by that example, you know? And I will never forget that.
I know. And even to go along with that, same thing applied to auditions. She would show up for almost every swing audition, understudy, you know, the tour stuff. If there was a replacement of the tour, somebody gave their 4-week notice, couldn't do it. She would, anytime she could make it and she wasn't somewhere else, she would show up. And I think when you have somebody at that caliber showing up in the room to make sure it's done the right way is so important. And it just makes you want to work even harder for them, whether you're the actor or the team member that's putting together a new cast. It's all in the same.
Yeah. And that's when it becomes not so much about commercial theater and it becomes about something bigger than that. It's like, we all now care about this thing because it means something more than dollar signs.
Exactly.
Which is really awesome. What has been your biggest challenge as a casting director?
I think it's probably the same challenge. Well, there's two things. One of them is the same challenge that most casting directors have, which is the age old problem of how do you help a team reach consensus without having an agenda? Because a lot of times, I'll be totally honest, I do have an agenda a lot of times in terms of who I think is going to fit the mold best in terms of what they've told me they need. I'm not saying that I'm going to shove that down their throat. That's not my job. My job is to help them see their vision in the way that they need to see it. I think consensus is always tricky when you have a team that's not on the same page and is fighting for different things. And that's never going to go away. I think the ways that we attack it have to be different depending on every personality that you run into. So that's the welcome challenge that I think everybody is going to, if you're in the casting industry, is going to run into. The other, I would say, is, you know, I think actors get a really bad rap in terms of being shoved into boxes really quickly. You're a theater actor, you're a TV actor, you're not an actor because you're a dancer. And my biggest challenge personally, I think, has been trying to show and convince creative teams that just because somebody doesn't have the resume they want to see, or just because somebody does have a resume that they have a preconceived notion about, doesn't mean they're not going to be able to deliver in a certain part. And I think I have to give credit to Bernie Telsey for that. He has been so incredible in helping teams understand that for crossover projects, it doesn't necessarily matter a lot of the time if they have done TV. It matters if they can do it. Right. You know, sure, you might not have gone to a Bob Krakauer class and learned so many tricks that you need to know in order to give a polished audition the first time. But if you are a Tony winning actor, or even if you're not a Tony winning actor and you come in and you give a great TV and film performance, you just might need a little help with some of the direction and the nuances, then you're right for that project, period. And I think the biggest challenge that I grapple with all the time is, how do we get creative teams and specifically directors to eliminate the boxes? How do we make them look at every actor in terms of a medium blind performer? That you're not a dancer, you're not a theater actor, you're not a TV actor, you're not a film actor, you're just an actor. How do we make that the thing that we can all agree on and go from there? And again, I think so many of the live musicals have helped, because that's been a hybrid of, you know, TV and film. And like, when I think about Jesus Christ Superstar, yes, you have to sing that stuff in a very specific way, and it's has to be done the right way. But it didn't matter what kind of person you were at the end of the day in terms of your resume. It mattered if you could do it or not. So I think that's something that I'm hoping will start to slowly break down over the next few years, is that we at least open the floodgates a little bit more in terms of giving people opportunity. Because, hey, you're never going to know unless you give the person the chance.
Well, I love hearing you say that. And also, you practice what you preach so much with that. On a personal level, I remember getting the appointment from you for A View from the Bridge, that the Old Vic production, that was a sexy, dark play that, like, you would think that you needed a Yale MFA degree to get in for. And I remember getting that appointment and being like, I had just come off of Cinderella, you know, like Rodgers and Hammerstein musical comedy. And it's like, no, I felt so seen in you trusting me to do that. And going through that process with you, I was like, wow, he sees me the way that I kind of want to see myself, you know?
Oh, I love that. If I can make anyone feel that way, that's incredible.
Yeah. Again, there's no question there. There's just me talking.
Nope. Just. But now you know that Joe really just wants to be in plays.
It's not just that. I will say, I'll out you on this one. Joe gave one of the best auditions for that Cinderella film we just cast. He gave one of the best auditions. He really did. And like, I don't think I'd ever seen you for a film and TV project before, right?
I don't think so. Did you work on Smash? Did you work on Smash back in the day?
I helped here and there, but I was not. I was mostly Tiffany and Bernie that did that.
Okay, because I think that one of my first auditions, which was bad with a capital B, was for when you guys were doing Smash. It was for one of those. I think it was the role that Jeremy Jordan got, and it was like one of my big auditions right out of college. And I was like, I think you may have been in the room for that. Maybe not. I was bad. Let's just move on. But thank you for saying that. Yeah, that Cinderella movie was another big one. It was like, whoa. Like, they're going to cast Shawn Mendes. What am I doing here? But like, you know what? I'm right. Thrilled. Thank you for saying that. That
was it's true. It was a lead role in a Sony motion picture, and they really wanted to see people who we thought fit the bill. And, you know, we got, of course, thousands and thousands of submissions for the roles when we put them out, especially for the Prince.
Right.
And I was like, I've seen Joe do something like that before, and I feel like he could do it. And he sings, and they're going to sing in this one. So let's try it. And you came in, and the thing that surprised me the most, I think, and I hope this isn't, you know, you don't take this the wrong way.
I won't.
You had zero nerves, like zero. And you had the lights on you and the camera set up and all that stuff. And I was like, good on him for not having like even a sliver of nervousness in this. Because I've never seen him in this medium before, and he's just walking in like he owns the place. I was like, that's pretty impressive. It's incredible.
Oh, that's so nice. That's all the time we have on Guys Who Like Musicals this week.
I hate you. That's because Dan helped him with all of his setup, so he was super comfortable with all those things in his face.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's very true.
Not totally true. I can't take all the credit, but I have seen plenty of Joe's self-tapes, and he is a great film actor. If you haven't seen him on The Politician, you should go give it a look on Netflix right now.
You're an asshole.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in business into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
I actually prefer TV auditions. Yeah. If I don't, this is really airing my dirty laundry, but if I don't have to sing, I'm not nervous.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating to me. A lot of people,
singing,
I feel
like...
Singing
is the thing that I'm like, ugh. But a lot of musical theater actors are like, oh God, it's a play or like, it's a movie. I don't know what to do. I'm the opposite.
That is very interesting. Most people would say the opposite because music is their safe zone and they feel like they can... Right. Give 100% without questions asked. And then they go into a film and TV setting and they realize the camera is so close on their face and they don't understand, you know, framing or whatever, or they do understand it and they just overthink it. That's interesting.
Right. Mm, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any books or resources that you find invaluable? I like to ask people, we're a big fan of like self-help books and artsy fartsy books.
Yeah. I don't know if it's as much of a self-help book, but in terms of, for anybody that's interested remotely in casting or being a casting director, I would watch the documentary Casting By, which is on Amazon Prime.
Oh, it's so good.
Even for me, you know, having been in the industry for a few years when it came out, it's just fascinating how it morphed into the career that it is from the studio system of the old Hollywood days up till now. And for anybody that is remotely interested in that as a career or as something they think they might want to try on the side, I would absolutely encourage people to read or to view that. And then the book that always comes back to my head, Jack O'Brien's book, The Accidental Education of an Unintentional Director. I mean, he is just a masterclass in every word that he writes and everything he says. Mm-hmm. And he's a Michigan grad, right?
He is.
Of course. There you go. Yeah.
He went to Michigan, but it was back in the day when there was a... it was before the BFA program. Right. They were like technically an offshoot of an English major. They were in the liberal arts school and they had the very famous touring rep company, the US touring rep company that I can't think of the name of, with Rosalind Russell was like the figurehead. And he was there like assistant directing Rosalind Russell in this play that was like traveling around the country and playing in rep in Manhattan. It's such a good book.
It's amazing.
I totally agree. I read that before the tour. It's such a good book.
Very excited.
He's also totally a genius.
See what he does next. He's one of my faves.
Yeah, his Twitter is also very enjoyable. His tweets about the Trump administration have been too funny. What is your favorite musical? Be careful.
This is like a Sophie's Choice question. Come on.
Joe and I really like to fight about what shows are good or not. So just don't choose the wrong one.
Okay, is this like gun to the head, you have to pick one?
It's more about like what your favorite musical is of your life, of your career, that was like the most influential, you know, like the first time you heard the Beatles.
Right. The last 5 years.
Nice.
I begged Bernie. I was like, I don't care if I'm the assistant.
Did you work on the movie?
I didn't work on the movie. I begged him to be involved in the second stage production that Betsy Wolf and Adam Cantor did.
Broadway one, yeah.
And I am so glad I did, because again, going back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, some of the actors who I think are most brilliant that I saw during that production did not book the job. And I always, one of the people who I remember seeing, and this will be etched in my brain forever, was Abby Mueller.
Yes.
And I remember her leaving the room and I was like, not only was that like a flawless audition and she should absolutely play the role or cover it, either one, but how does nobody else understand how brilliant this girl is? Like, she was incredible. And then at the same time, so many of the guys that I happened to be in the room for, and I think I was like the assistant or the associate on it. I wasn't even the one in charge. Bernie was in charge of that one. So many of them ended up being people that I see all the time now. And I'm so excited when I get the chance to see them in something, because it's like, I remember you from that audition and you've grown so far and you took all the good things that you came in the room with that time and you kept them. But more than that, I've just been the biggest, nerdiest Jason Robert Brown fan since I was like 16 years old. And to be involved with that. And that story, I think, is something that is so heartbreaking and incredible. I was also the first Jamie to ever play it in college.
Oh,
that's a fun trivia fact.
Our professor told us that that school was the first school that got the rights to do Last 5 Years, and I played Jamie. Right, so there's Dan. A little personal thing there too.
Dan, we gotta contact somebody at Drew University and get that bootleg.
We sure do. Get that bootleg. Oh, and drop no. it in
I
here.
Hope it's not around. Oh God, guys, I could not sing those B flats. I don't know what they were thinking.
Oh man, that show is so good though. So good. I definitely wore out my Norbert Leo Butts, and I've worn out my Jeremy Jordan like days ago.
Yeah.
Like I'm still listening to his Moving Too Fast, and
it's so good.
The next 10 minutes was a bop, but also Nobody Needs to Know.
It's just every song in that show is just like, how do you not hear it and then not, like, I sing the song like 20 days after I hear it once. I don't know why Jason has that ability to etch things in your brain like that, but it's incredible. And I think part of what makes his writing so brilliant is exactly that. It's timeless in the sense of you learn something new about it every single time you listen to it. And I think where I listen to it now as a 36-year-old is much different than a 16-year-old or a 22-year-old or a 27-year-old or a 31-year-old. It's always about, you know, where you are in time in that moment that makes you have a different look on it.
100%. I listened to
and
it way
are
different.
Are you going to be mad?
I was just going to say, I listened to it way different as someone who's married for like 2 years.
Yeah. Right.
I'm like, oh shit. Just like, you know, I don't know.
Do I need to call Alex, Joe?
No, we're good. We're it's a pandemic. We still really like each other, but I mean, you know, it's, yeah, that you're so right. God, now I got the song.
Are you
going to
be mad
head.
If anybody brings that into an audition, though?
No. Here's the thing. This is, if we're going to get into brass tacks, you are making a ballsy ass move if you're bringing in a JRB song to an accompanist that does not know JRB very well. Like, that's a gamble.
Right.
Yep.
And hopefully we do have an accompanist that can play it that well, but not everybody can do that style of music 100% by looking at it once. Like, so I think, know what you're getting into if you're deciding to bring in a Jason Robert Brown song to an audition.
Totally.
I like that. Which kind of transitions into my next question. Sort of. What advice, because I kind of want to ask this in two parts. I want to know like what advice you would give to your young self. So somebody who might be interested in casting, but I also kind of want to know what advice you would have for somebody like who's going to walk into a Pat Goodwin audition after this pandemic for the first time. What do you think they should do?
And also, if you have any advice for a couple of 30-year-olds who started a podcast, who also hope very much to audition for you after the pandemic is over.
That's right. And be specific.
Be very specific.
I have a
project, role, date that you will be seen post-pandemic, all of those.
That's correct.
Yeah. In terms of the actor that's going to walk in a room after this or that I'll meet or that I'll Zoom with or that we'll send in a self tape, we're your biggest champion. A casting director has zero reason for you to want to do anything other than your very best at any given time, period. It would make no sense for us to invite you to an audition to want you to not do well. Like, that does not happen. That's not part of my vocabulary as a human being, and it's not part of what we do as a community of casting directors. That's just not it. So know that we're rooting for you and know that we want you to succeed. And I think I take a lot of responsibility on myself to make that room as comfortable and as stress-free as we can within our ability to make sure you're able to give your best work. I forgot your first question. What was it?
What would you give to your young self? Oh, what advice would you give for somebody?
100%. My advice to my young self would be, don't rush. I am the kind of person that I want to get 6 steps ahead if I can. I want to, you know, be as far along in my career, in my life, in terms of how much money I'm making, and all that stuff. And I learned in my 20s that is just not worth your time and effort to worry about. You have so many other things that you could be filling your time with that are artistically worthwhile, or, you know, worthwhile as a human being to focus on. Don't rush. Don't feel like you need to have a Tony nomination at 35 because that was a goal you set for yourself, or don't feel like you have to own a house by the time you're 30, or don't feel like you have to have booked your first tour a year out of college. I don't think that kind of goal setting is going to do anybody any good. I think real goal setting is more attainable than that, and more likely to be smaller scale so that you can grasp it without having to look back with regret. And I went through a long time, I think in my early to mid 20s, beating myself up over how I wasn't further along and where I thought I was supposed to be. And now I look back and I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I'm so grateful for it. And I still have a long way to go from there.
Oh, I love
that. That's really good.
I need that right now.
Such good advice. Yep. Right. Because you can't have your goal be something that's out of your control. That's the moral of the story. It's like, you can be in control of, I want to read 30 books this year.
Exactly.
You can't be in control of, I get 30 guest stars this year. It's not up to you.
Exactly.
Totally.
Perfectly put.
That's so great.
Well, I was just reiterating what you said. You're the pro.
You're much more eloquent and specific with it, though.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think that's true either. Where can people find you, Pat? If social media and or otherwise, you said that you teach. I mean, we saw, you know, you teach a lot. You teach at many different places, Broadway Workshop and Pace University, various places. Where can people find you?
Yeah, I do teach at Pace. I've been there for about 5 years as an adjunct professor. I'm on Twitter. I'm not heavily on it. Let's just put it. I have a lot of venting to do for the Trump administration on there. Yeah. And then there were some tweets that I felt like I needed to get rid of because I was a little too upset in the moment. but no, I'm around. I try to dedicate a lot of my time now, helping out and volunteering for kids organizations.
Cool.
Kids theater organizations in terms of classes that they're doing and things like that. So if you happen to see my name on one of those things, 9 times out of 10, it's totally free. The only times that it's not is if it's an administration thing for that organization or something. So if you happen to see my name at, like, you know, a workshop that's being taught on Zoom for a bunch of people in Texas, that's great. Or Stage Door sometimes does stuff. There's all sorts of little things like that. I try to keep it spread out and as free or cost effective as possible. And then post pandemic, who knows where I'll be, guys. Hopefully not in this room. Hopefully not on Zoom. Hopefully with you guys at a bar having a beer.
Yes, amen. Yes. Oh my gosh. Amen.
Yeah.
Pat, I can speak for Dan, but I'll let him do it in a second. You said this earlier, and I just want to reiterate that you make every room that we feel that we walk into as actors, you make those rooms feel so welcoming and so warm. You are so kind. Thank you for everything that you have done for me, for my friend here. You're an absolute joy. Anytime that I get an appointment from you, I'm really excited to go in. So thank you for everything. Thank you for your trust. Dan, and now it's time for you to gush over our guest.
You don't need to do that.
Well, no, but I now that we've gotten to the end, if they've made it here, then they have to listen to this story. But the specific way in which I was cast in Waitress was crazy because I was really needed a job. And Pat sent me an audition for the tour of Waitress to understudy to play the role I eventually got to play on Broadway, but the tracking on the tour was a little bit different. And I went in, that was the audition where Pat was laughing hysterically and it went really well. And the next day I got an offer to play the role and I threw up the danger signs because I was not ready to go on tour. I went in on this audition wanting to be considered for Broadway and thinking, I'm not going to get this job. I just want to show Pat that, like, I'm really good for this role and we'll see what happens. Well, I get the job. It goes back and forth. The producers end up giving me what I wanted in the negotiation. And then I still turned it down. And my agent was like, you're never going to work for them again. And it was terrible. And 2 weeks later, you called me in for Rent Live. And I was like, hey, man, I'm so sorry about Waitress. You were like, Dan, what are you talking about? You're an actor. You're allowed to turn jobs down. Like, it's okay. Don't worry about it. Sure enough, 6 months, 5 months later, whatever, Matt DeAngelis leaves the show on Broadway to go to the tour. I get an appointment to play Pometer on the road and you come out after my audition and tell me that they want me to read with Sarah tomorrow for a role on Broadway. Right. And I was like, what is going on?
It's the typical like waitress, we're going to throw you for a loop kind of thing. I know. I remember this right. very well.
but that advice of like, you know, it's another testament to like how you speak to actors and how you're looking out for us and making us feel like you understand what we're going through. And that little piece of advice is another thing that is going to, that changed my outlook on the business and having ownership, which is something that we have to like learn how to do, is how to say no to stuff and how to decide what auditions you go to and figure out what's right for you and your family and not just kind of jump at whatever comes your way. And I appreciate that lesson, and I appreciate you and your attitude and all of that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate both of you guys for letting me be the one to say I was able to cast you in those parts.
Yes. Brilliant. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And we'll see you on the other side of all of this for in-person auditions.
Cocktails in hand.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to Guys Who Like Musicals. We are now part of the Broadway Podcast Network.
Woo!
We are hosted by Dan Tracy.
That's you.
And Joe Carroll.
That's me.
We're produced by Ryan Kincaid, and Matthew Mucha is the social content manager.
You can find us on Instagram at Guys Who Like Musicals, on Twitter at Musical Guys, or the old-fashioned way at www.guyswholikemusicals.com.
If you'd like a chance to be featured on the Ask the Guys segment of our show, please call 203-900-7990 and leave a message with your question. As always, thanks for listening.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.